Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Limited vaccine supply and unequal distribution means that lower-income countries consistently struggle to access essential vaccines that are in demand by wealthier countries, according to the latest Global Vaccine Market Report released by the World Health Organization, or WHO. This is the first to examine the implications of COVID-19 for vaccine markets. It highlights the disparity in access around the world. The report says the way the global market works is not fully conducive to the development, supply and access for essential vaccines, with some regions depending almost entirely on others for vaccine supply. The right to health includes the right to vaccines, said Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, WHO Director General, adding that the report shows that free market dynamics are depriving some of the world's poorest and most vulnerable people of that right. WHO is calling for much-needed changes in vaccine distribution to save lives, prevent disease, and prepare for future crises. There are concerns over the health and life of a human rights defender in prison in Saudi Arabia, whose family haven't heard from him since they complained that he was being attacked by other inmates more than 2 weeks ago. Mohammed Al-Qahtani is serving a 10-year sentence. Mary Lawler, the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights Defenders, has called on relevant authorities to inform his family of his whereabouts and current state of health, and to allow his family and lawyers to see him. She said Wednesday that the use of incommunicado detention is a violation of detainees' rights under international law, and that such methods put detainees at a heightened risk of being ill-treated and tortured. And finally, a unique cookbook that infuses mouth-watering recipes from around the world with insights into the global fish trade has been launched by the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO. Fish, Know It, Cook It, Eat It blends scientific facts and cultural history with nutritional information and sustainability concerns, as well as including recipes from 45 FAO member countries. Dishes range from a Korean braised mackerel with radish to St. Lucia's national dish of green fig and saltfish. Published as the UN-designated International Year of Artisanal Fisheries and Aquaculture draws to a close, the book is also a call to action, highlighting FAO's efforts to combat illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing. Nikki Chadwick, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with professor and historian Alfred McCoy about his new book, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change.
It takes a giant in the world of historians to write a book like this.
We speak with the great investigative reporter, Lisa Graves. She has, for the last 10 years, been looking into the influence of dark money on recruiting and placing ultra-right-wing lawyers on our federal benches.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
Today we speak with University of Wisconsin history professor Alfred McCoy about his new book, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. The United States of America has been governing the globe now for 80 years, since World War II. This is about to end. By 2030, China will have the world's largest economy and hold more in riches than the U.S., which is deeply in debt. The America we knew will change drastically as a world power, just as the previous world powers, the British, and before them the Dutch, and before them the Spanish and the Portuguese, all saw their empires end.
climate change will upend the world. It already has started. The effects of climate change on the population of the world, especially China, will be catastrophic. The great coastal city of Shanghai, where 18 million people reside, will sink. Millions of the 400 million Chinese people in the North China Plain will be forced to evacuate. What can we learn from the demise of the great world powers in the past? Where is the United States headed, and how soon? What might be done to ameliorate this dire future? Only a prodigious historian would undertake to answer these questions. Our guest today is such an historian. Alfred W. McCoy holds the Fred Harvey Harrington Chair of History at the University of Wisconsin. He has written 20 books, including The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, for which he became well known, and recently In the Shadows of the American Century. We welcome Professor Al McCoy back to Law and Disorder to talk with us about the important new book, To Govern the Globe. Al McCoy, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Michael and Marjorie. Pleased to be here.
Al, we owe your magnificent book to a fall you took on the ice on one of those terrible Wisconsin winter days. I've got a picture in my head of you sitting on a chair at a table with your leg extended in a cast, working 18 hours a day, every day for a year on that manuscript. Was that what it was like?
Well, no, that's pretty accurate. First of all, it wasn't a cast because it wasn't a bone break. I just shredded three tendons in the knee. So it was a mechanical brace, and it was not 12 months, but 5 months. But for 5 months, I was confined to a chair. I couldn't really walk. I couldn't drive. I couldn't get on an airplane. Fortunately, I was on sabbatical. So I just really, and also because of the leg brace, I couldn't really sleep more than about 5 hours a night. So basically, I just sat in that chair for 5 months, with great stacks of books and articles and the internet, and by the time the brace came off in summer, I had the first draft of a book. And then it took me another year of cleaning it up and also realizing what I was trying to say.
That's great, Al. The United States has been a major world power for the last 80 years since World War II. It's a world power in the economic, military, and political spheres. Can you please talk about this?
Sure. At the end of World War II, in the midst of this cataclysm that left over 70 million people dead and cities destroyed on several continents, the United States emerged as the most powerful empire that had ever existed, the most powerful empire in human history. And we use that power to do two things. One, to establish our hegemony and dominance of the globe beyond the Soviet bloc and then the Sino-Soviet bloc. And second, what we did was we used that power in concert with allies and in dialogue with civil society groups, and that dialogue with civil society groups was tremendously important, to build a world order. That it was in many ways the culmination of the struggle for human rights over the past five centuries. And that world order, which was enshrined in the UN and a whole succession of like international organizations, was founded on two basic principles. One, all human beings had universal human rights, and all human communities had the right to live in a sovereign state, and that sovereign state had inviolable sovereignty. And like all world orders in the past, this world order had a duality between power and principle, and that power was exercised by the world's most enormously powerful military and also by a very new method of projecting power, the CIA and covert projection of power. And so there was a yawning contradiction in that system. One, the United States had built this liberal international order where every nation had inviolable sovereignty, and yet the United States was a great global hegemon, and in the asymmetric nature of the power, the United States necessarily had to violate that sovereignty. So how could the United States break its own rules? Well, the only way to do it was to do it covertly. And so in 1947, we established the Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, and it was originally supposed to be an intelligence organization, but it very quickly transformed into a covert apparatus for intervening overseas, for intervening when we couldn't be seen to intervene, in other words, to do it covertly. And it was the CIA that gained enormous power because it mediated that fundamental contradiction in the U.S. world order.
We're speaking with historian Al McCoy about his new book, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. Al, in the past 700 years, there have been other world powers, the Iberian power of the Spanish and the Portuguese, then the Dutch, then the British. What lessons can we learn from their rise and decline?
Yeah, really from the 16th century right to the present, there has been, as you just said, Michael, this amazingly diverse array of dominant world powers, all the way from rather small, lightly populated Portugal to the United States, which is a major continental power. But through this succession, there has been one absolute constant. The rise of every nation to global power has been coincident with its dominance over the vast Eurasian landmass. And the decline of that same power has coincided with its loss of control over that same Eurasian landmass. And so it is with the United States. You know, at the end of World War II, when we had that enormous power that we've just been talking about, the United States became, as a British historian named John Darwin has argued, the first power in 1,000 years to control both axial ends of Eurasia. And how do we do this? Well, at the start of the Cold War in the late 1940s, the United States formed a NATO alliance, and we built massive bases like Ramstein Air Base in Germany, and that gave us a secure anchor at the western axial end of Eurasia. And then on October 1st, 1949, when Mao Zedong stood up in Beijing at Tiananmen Square and announced the formation of the People's Republic of China, and then within months forged an alliance with the Soviet Union, creating the Sino-Soviet bloc, an alliance between Stalin and Mao, suddenly the United States realized that containing communism wasn't just a matter of Europe, it was global. And so the United States very quickly in 1951 and then 1953 signed 4 mutual security pacts with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia, giving us this Pacific littoral, a line of massive military bases stretching from Japan through the Philippines all the way down to Australia. We didn't have actual bases in Australia, but the Australians had their own. And this Pacific littoral, which the Chinese call the First Island Chain, became the fulcrum for U.S. geopolitical power, the fulcrum for the defense of one continent, North America, and the projection of power to dominate another continent, Eurasia. And then the United States ringed those 2 axial points, those 2 anchors of bases at the west and east of Eurasia, with successive chains of steel. First of all, mutual defense pacts stretching from NATO in Europe to CETO in Southeast Asia and ANZUS with Australia and New Zealand. Next, 2 powerful fleets, the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean Atlantic, the 7th Fleet in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific, and then we added later on the 5th Fleet in the Persian Gulf, and then hundreds of military bases, thousands of bombers and missiles, and we ringed Eurasia with these powerful chains of steel, and we contained the Sino-Soviet bloc behind that iron curtain, and that was the key to our success in the Cold War. We could simply sit back and wait for our rivals to make mistakes or not, as the case turned out. And, you know, that the breaking of those chains are what the world is witnessing today in Ukraine and in the South China Sea.
Al, as the Spaniards slaughtered the native populations in the Caribbean and Mexico, there was internal opposition. I'm thinking specifically of the Dominican priest Bartolome de las Casas, and also the Quaker and Methodist opposition to the British slave trade. Can you discuss that, please?
Sure. First of all, I said, you know, at the beginning, every world order has a duality between power manifest in empire and principle, which is articulated by civil society activists, most often people that have profound principles, and historically these are religious principles. Bartolome de las Casas was not only a critic of Spanish imperial conquest, he participated in the conquest of Cuba, and he, as he describes in his short history, his famous short history, his most translated and read work, he was in Cuba, and he describes, for example, that he said the natives laid before us a feast, and we sat down, and to enjoy that feast, and then we slaughtered 300 of them. And he describes this succession of massacres that, in some, destroyed the indigenous population of the Caribbean, the Tainos and the Arawak, who only remain survived today in the genes of the peoples of the Caribbean. They've basically been extinguished. And De Las Casas had reading the Bible, had a blinding moment of spiritual insight and devoted the rest of his life to not only exposing these great crimes but trying to stop them. And he started, at the very end of his life, he came to a realization. First of all, he wanted the Spanish to stop enslaving and slaughtering the Amerindians. So for a while, he actually suggested the African slave trade might be an alternative. Then he realized that this was a great crime. And in his last writings, he recognized that he had made a terrible mistake, because what he realized is that everybody, pagan and Christian alike, we're all humans, and we all have human rights. And that realization of fundamental humanity came right at the start of this process. And that unleashed a kind of dialogue that other Dominicans, like Francisco de Vitoria, who was a lecturer in law at a Spanish university, he gave very famous lectures that were recorded and published. And that inspired Hugo Grotius, the great Dutch legal scholar, who's often considered the architect of international law and the modern international system. And that dialogue extended to the United Kingdom, where, again, the so-called dissenting churches, the Quakers, the Methodists, and evangelical Anglicans, decided that in the late 18th century, when Britain's empire, as major activity, was the Middle Passage, over half the slaves carried across the Atlantic in the latter decades of the 18th century, which is the peak of the slave trade, were carried on British ships. And the profits from the sale of the slaves, the work on the British West Indies plantations, all of that produced enormous wealth for Great Britain. So at this peak of British imperial power, these dissenting churches launched this massive campaign. An island nation of 10 million people in Britain, they got a petition with 1 million signatures. And in 1807, the British Parliament announced, they passed legislation abolishing the slave trade. And at the settlement of the Napoleonic Wars in the Congress of Vienna, Article 15 in the treaty, which most people don't read, not aware of, is this ringing denunciation of the slave trade, calling on all the nations of the world to abolish it. And as soon as the Napoleonic Wars were over, the British Navy, the Royal Navy, the most powerful military force on the planet, spent the next 70 and 80 years with its prime military mission, the abolition of the slave trade. They lost 15,000 sailors in that fight, and spent about 2% of their gross domestic product, and they succeeded in abolishing the slave trade. Of course, there's always that other side of the duality. That's principle, created by those civil society groups, enshrined in law and enforced by naval power. But then there was the other realpolitik side of British imperial power, and they conquered colonies and introduced forced labor, unpaid forced labor, in the European colonies in the imperial age from the 1880s to the 1930s. Ordinary people, adult males, all adult males had to work between 16 and 20 days a year of free labor building imperial infrastructure. So it was a halfway station on the path to human rights. And then at San Francisco in 1945, again, as the Americans were, at the end of World War II, Europe was in ruins. The British Empire was in decline, although they hadn't realized it yet. It was all over for imperialism. And at this moment, when the United States was setting up this current international order, the first conference to form the UN was near Washington, D.C. at Dumbarton Oaks. And it was kind of a closed-door imperial club, and they agreed that the Security Council would be all-powerful. And as Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, they would have an assembly so that the little countries could get together once a year and blow off steam. Okay, so it was supposed to be a closed imperial club. And then they took that to San Francisco, where all kinds of delegations turned up from American religious groups, Jewish groups, the NAACP, labor unions. There was Latin American delegates had a kind of pre-UN conference, and they came with their principles. And the United Nations, the more open, equitable organization that we have today, was transformed by that civil society input. So civil society is of paramount importance in articulating and propagating these principles that temper the ruthlessness of empire.
We're speaking with Al McCoy, who's originally written To Govern the Globe, World Orders, and Catastrophic Change. Al, You write that the United States will be eclipsed by China by the year 2030. How so?
Sure. First of all, it's not just me that's been saying this. The U.S. National Intelligence Council, which is the supreme analytic body of the U.S. intelligence community, every 4 years writes a predictive report. And back in 2012, I think it was, they issued their report, and they said that by 2030, if not before, China's economy will be larger than the U.S. economy. And he said that we're witnessing an historic shift of power. In the 18th century, power moved from Asia to Europe, and now it's moving from west to east. And in terms of global power, economic strength, they said we can predict that Asia will be more powerful than the United States by 2030. And the international accounting firm, PricewaterhouseCoopers, known as PwC, predicted that by 2030, in terms of real purchasing power, China's economy will be 60% larger than the U.S. economy. Now, since over the long term, the United States and China spend roughly 2 and about 3% of their gross domestic product on defense and defense procurements. If China's economy is 60% larger, they're going to be spending more, and they have a very lively and growing defense military establishment. And they are no longer a near peer competitor. They're a peer competitor, and they're now moving, I think, beyond parity. Just take late last year, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff said that he had a near Sputnik moment because China had successfully tested a hypersonic missile. Now, that's a missile that flies at least 4,000 miles an hour. The United States has been trying to develop hypersonic missiles, and every test we've had has basically burned up because they're flying so fast. So it's an enormously technologically challenged issue. China's done it. And that means they have a missile that can penetrate any possible continental U.S. air defenses. In other words, they can strike, they can launch a nuclear strike on any American city, and we can't stop them. And more importantly, that means they can knock any American aircraft carrier out of the water about anywhere in the Pacific, particularly close to China itself, where they have more conventional missiles called carrier killer missiles that are already capable of taking out an American aircraft carrier. So when your military establishment knows that if it comes to war, we lose, that tempers your foreign policy. That means you give way to the dominant superior power. And that is just now starting to happen.
Al, how does the accelerating climate change catastrophe figure into all of this? For example, the huge coastal city of Shanghai going underwater, or people on the plains of China dying of heat stroke, and the massive population migrations that would ensue.
Sure. First of all, prediction is enormously difficult. My own discipline, history, when we try and track the past and the future, we usually get it wrong, and not only wrong, but almost laughably so. Economics and political science don't like even medium-term predictions. They don't like to go much beyond the next election or maybe the next recession. But environmental science is different. The whole logic of environmental science is developing tools of observation, like ice cores, pulling ice cores out of Antarctica and Greenland and analyzing them. And then making projections all the way to the end of the century, grounded in computer modeling, natural science research, bringing all these diverse tools together into this very powerful science of environmental prediction. So what I did in my book was very simple. I simply took those environmental trajectories, I read the science, which is published in journals like Nature Communications, peer-reviewed, very solid, and I read the UN reports, and I simply overlaid on top of that likely changes in the political order that might be caused by this change. Okay, so if let's assume that the United States is a waning imperial power and China is on the ascent, and somewhere around 2030, China begins to build an alternative world order, okay? So how long is their world order going to last? My sense is if you look at the environmental science, they've only got about two or three decades on top, which is not long for an empire, not long for a world order. Why? Well, first of all, by 2050, and the environmental science is very clear on this, sea levels will be rising, and Shanghai is arguably the most vulnerable city in the world to sea level rise, except perhaps maybe Miami. But it's very similar. It's not up a river like London. It's not protected by something like the Verrazano Narrows in New York, where you can put up a sea gate. You know, it's a coastal city, and it was dredged from swamp and sea starting in the 15th century. And the environmental science is very clear. By 2050, most of Shanghai is underwater. And that means a city of 18 million people and the economic engine for much of the Chinese economy is going to basically be underwater. The next thing is it's not just global warming, it's global heating. And a professor at MIT has published an article in Nature Communications, and he said that by 2070, there will be hundreds of extreme weather events in the North China Plain, which will become, he says, one of the least habitable places on the planet. Now, the North China Plain is currently home to 400 million people. It's the agricultural, in many ways, the demographic heartland of China. 400 million people is 30% of China's total population. And those, not only will there be hundreds of extreme weather events, but there are going to be at least five events in which there will be 35 degrees centigrade wet bulb temperature. Now, what does all that mean? That means that in the balance of heat and humidity, at that point, 35 degrees, the human body can't sweat. And so all of us, you, me, and Michael, sitting here, we'd be dead in 6 hours at rest under 35-degree wet bulb temperature. And there'll be five protracted incidents of that lethal, fatal climate. Well, as China recoils from the damage to its coastal cities and the successive heat waves hitting its agricultural heartland, diminished crops, dislocations of population, it's going to have to pull back from the world and begin to address serious domestic issues. And worldwide, there are now 200 million people will be uprooted by climate change by 2050. There are now other projections from other groups that say it's as high as 1.2 billion people will be climate change refugees by 2050. The existing world order is absolutely incapable of handling that kind of movement. You know, think back. Between 2016 and 2018, we had Middle Easterners coming into the Greek islands into Europe, the Sub-Saharan Africans crossing the Sahel, the Sahara Desert, and crossing the Mediterranean. We had Central Americans and some Mexicans, but mainly Central Americans, gathering at the U.S. border and trying to cross. And this was a shock to the international order that produced this rise of ultra-nationalist right-wing groups across the world. It led to Britain leaving the European Union. When you add up those Middle Eastern, African, and Central American refugees, that's only 2 million people in total were a shock to the current world order. And so by 2050, when you're talking about 200 million or 1.2 billion climate change refugees, the current international system is simply incapable of handling it, and it will crumble and collapse under that kind of pressure. So around 2050, we'll be without a global hegemon, we'll be without a world order, we'll be facing a world disorder, and we need to think about alternatives.
How do you see the Russian invasion of Ukraine following the expansion of the U.S.-controlled military alliance NATO up to the border of Russia and the U.S.-sponsored 2014 coup in the Ukraine as being a fight to control what you talk about, controlling the Eurasian landmass?
Sure. You recall earlier I said that the geopolitical basis for U.S. global power has been, since the late 1940s, for the better part of 75 years, has rested upon the military dominance and the over Eurasia, initially containing the Sino-Soviet bloc behind the Iron Curtain, but even in the aftermath of Cold War, maintaining that apparatus of control to dominate this. Because, as I said, every world power, every global hegemon since the 16th century has dominated Eurasia. Eurasia is home to 70% of the world's population and productivity. In order to be a world power, you have to dominate Eurasia. So what we're looking at is something we haven't seen since the Stalin Mao alliance, which lasted actually very briefly from 1950 to 1953, and very quickly those two powers split. So it's really been about 60 years that we haven't seen an alliance between the two major powers on the Eurasian landmass. Putin and Xi Jinping are allied, and they're allied in a very similar strategy of trying to mount pressure to snap those chains of steel that the United States laid around the Eurasian landmass. And this means Eurasia has been a kind of ring of fire, and if you connect the dots, the geopolitical dots around the continent, what you see is the pressure in Ukraine, the U.S. pullout from Afghanistan, which China made possible by ringing Afghanistan with a geopolitical change that basically isolated the United States. There are military maneuvers in the Himalayas with the Indian Army mobilizing troops to check China. There's the Quad, the alliance between Japan, Australia, the United States, and India conducting the Malabar live-firing naval exercise in the Bay of Bengal. There's China swarming its aircraft in the Taiwan Strait. It's a joint Russian-Chinese fleet that late last year just steamed around all of Japan, formerly U.S. waters. And then there are maneuvers in the Arctic, joint maneuvers by China and Russia. And so basically what's happened is that China and Russia together are mounting this campaign of tension, this campaign of pressure to slowly snap those chains of steel, push the United States off the Eurasian landmass, drive wedges in the NATO alliance, weaken the bilateral ties between those four powers, Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, Australia, and the United States, and thus take control of the Eurasian landmass and emerge as the dominant powers in the world. And that's what we're witnessing. It's an epical change. So that economic decline of the relative decline of the United States, China's ascent economically, China's ascent militarily, it also has a geopolitical dimension, and we will see a succession of like events going on all around this ring of fire, around the 6,000 miles of the Eurasian landmass, for till the end of the decade, by which time U.S. global power will be over, and then we'll see a new form of dominance in Eurasia and the rise of a new global power.
Well, thank you, Al McCoy. We've run out of our allotted time. This is a good point to end, and we recommend heartily that our listeners read your new book, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. It's available from Haymarket Books. Thank you very much, Al, for your time today and for your good work over the many years. We wish you the best.
Thank you. Thank you, guys, very much, everybody, for having me on the show. Okay?
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The nation is still reeling from the Trump administration's assault to the rule of law and their ripple effects on democratic institutions. But these attacks were the result of strategic planning over decades and the handiwork of networks of well-funded think tanks and lobbyists. Some of the country's richest and most conservative, really reactionary, individuals are, with so-called dark money, anonymously supporting these efforts. Chief among those forces is the Federalist Society. Not well known until recently, the Society has worked quietly since the Reagan administration to overhaul the Supreme Court into a bastion of reaction. Enriched with dark money, it's had an outsized impact on the composition of the federal courts and the Supreme Court. Recently, we've witnessed how hard-fought social gains of the 20th century have been taken away from Americans, and landmark Supreme Court decisions have been overruled, such as Roe v. Wade on a woman's right to reproductive freedom, and Lemon v. Kurtzman guaranteeing the separation of church and state. Today, we are rebroadcasting an interview from late 2021 with attorney Lisa Graves. Our conversation makes clear how such attacks on civil liberties have come to be. Lisa is the founder, director, and editor-in-chief of True North Research. Her analysis of such research has been cited by every major newspaper in the country. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of government. Lisa served as chief counsel for the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee for Senator Patrick Leahy. She was also a career deputy assistant attorney general in the U.S. Department of Justice. Lisa has spent the last 12 years examining the impact of dark money on judicial selection. Lisa Graves, a real pleasure to have you on Law & Disorder. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's a joy to be on with you.
At the Amy Comey Barrett confirmation hearings in the Senate, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island called the hearings, quote, a puppet show. He said the strings were being pulled by dark money, that the objective was to remake the national judiciary, diminish the civil jury, weaken the regulatory agencies which protect the public trust, allow unlimited money in politics, and restrict voting rights. Please talk about his testimony. Talk about dark money. What is it and who has it?
Well, I think what Senator Whitehouse did this past month in describing what's happening to our Supreme Court and the dark money swirling around it is of vital public importance. And that's because what we have here is a situation where a very powerful man named Leonard Leo, who is the co-chair of the Federal Society, which describes itself as a group of conservative and libertarian lawyers and law students, actually has been playing a key role in packing U.S. courts, federal courts, the Supreme Court, and other courts. Leonard Leo is the person who chooses the judges that Trump chooses from, and he's choosing people to advance an agenda that he himself described at a closed-door meeting that the Washington Post revealed last year. At that closed-door meeting to funders, Leonard Leo said that America stands at the precipice, at the edge of what he described as the revival of what he called the structural constitution, the likes of which no one had seen since before the New Deal. And he basically described how no one in that room that he was speaking to was alive to see the kind of legal revolution that was underway due to these appointments. That effort to basically roll back a century of law that the right wing in this country dislikes is an unprecedented sort of extreme effort to re-engineer America in their own image. And they're doing it with dark money. Dark money in the electoral context is money that is not disclosed because it's not given directly to a candidate. It's money that is spent to help that candidate win. And the Supreme Court under Roberts has already begun that structural revolution that Leonard spoke of. And that's because in the Citizens United decision, it said that Congress could not regulate and limit that outside spending by those groups if they didn't, you know, go directly to the candidate call for that candidate's election. It said in the Shelby County case on voting rights that basically the Voting Rights Act of 1965 could be gutted based on that narrow majority on that court. And also it said in the recent redistricting cases that other courts could not intervene, even where there was gross, extreme partisan redistricting that was denying fair representation to Americans in terms of who represents them in Congress. And so this revolution is underway, and we don't know who the major funders are. We know they're people who can write million-dollar checks to influence who gets on the U.S. Supreme Court and help push them through despite their controversy. We do know Charles Koch, who's one of the richest billionaires, in the whole wide world, is very invested in trying to capture our courts to accomplish his extreme agenda. But we don't know who all the funders are who are having such a disproportionate impact on who gets chosen for the court and how they get pushed through. We also know, as Senator Whitehouse pointed out, that many of the groups that are getting money from those same interests are also bringing cases to the Supreme Court to get those decisions that they dislike overturned.
Lisa, now that Barrett is on the Supreme Court, the reactionaries have a majority. How will this affect upcoming cases like the legality of Obamacare, gay marriage, and the right of a woman to control her own body?
Well, I think those cases are in grave jeopardy, and that's because Leonard Leo was choosing judges to meet the litmus test that the president, President Trump, and his party have said that they're going to impose on this court, and that includes trying to choose judges who are going to overturn the Affordable Care Act, who are going to overturn Roe versus Wade. That's their agenda. It's explicit. We know that gay rights are also at stake or at issue here. That's because this reactionary majority that's been chosen has hostility to the rights of LGBTQ Americans. And we know from a decision just this past week where Justice Thomas and Justice Alito issued an opinion basically in the case involving the clerk that refused to issue the marriage license, that they're trying to use freedom of worship not as a shield, but as a sword to strike down the rights of other Americans, and in particular, the rights of LGBTQ Americans. But also, we know that this president has said that he wants and he wanted Justice Barrett on the court. He wanted her on the court because he wants her vote in election cases that are going to be coming to the court that are on their way right now, in which he's going to be trying to stop votes from being counted by Americans in order to win this election by judicial fiat. And so a huge number of rights are at risk, but also other rights, as those that were alluded to in the Leonard Leo speech about this legal revolution to roll back a whole century of precedents around the laws that were passed in the New Deal.
I'm thinking about the Janus case, and before that, Citizens United, and the Shelby County case that you mentioned. Might you please speak about these?
Yes, it's certainly the case that the right wing in this country has targeted labor rights, has targeted a number of statutes and judicial decisions to try to reverse the rights of Americans to organize and to negotiate all the terms of their working conditions with powerful corporations. What you have in many ways in these past several years is the sort of supremacy of corporate rights over individual rights. You can see that in the Hobby Lobby case. In that case, there was a retailer, a craft store, that claimed that the company had religious beliefs that would bar it from allowing its employees, the clerks, the women who work for those at that retailer, from having access to IUDs, which is a common birth control device. And so that company's corporate sort of, quote, religious beliefs were elevated over the actual rights of human beings, the women who work there, and their rights to access affordable health care, including birth control. Meanwhile, after that decision was issued, that company was found to have stolen 11,000 artifacts from the Middle East. And so apparently the thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal religious dictate didn't apply to them, but they were going to impose this view by a corporation about women's access to birth control as a religious belief. That's not all. We've seen that in the Citizens United case, where the right of a corporation, a nonprofit or for-profit corporation to quote speech, meaning spending money, was elevated over our rights to have laws that protect against corruption in our democracy. And that supremacy of this corporate right to spend money as speech has taken place in a period in which we've seen tremendous crackdowns on actual human beings speaking out in protest and dissent over pipelines, over racial injustice in this country, and other issues. And so this court really has embraced a notion of corporate supremacy that is totally dissonant and inconsistent with the core principles and rights actually protected for human beings in our Constitution.
Lisa, tell us more about Leonard Leo, Federalist Society leader. The Society is responsible for selecting judges that the Republican Senate goes on to confirm. Over 200 federal judges have recently been put in place in the lower appellate and Supreme Court, as we've seen. Tell us a bit more about Leo's agenda and his connections to the reactionary right wing.
Yes, you know, it is the case that the Federal Society has been given a privileged role in judicial selection in Republican administrations, and no more privileged role than this current one, where Leonard Leo, who is now the co-chair of the Federal Society and previously its executive vice president, where he has been tasked by Trump with actually choosing the slate of judges that he picks from for the U.S. Supreme Court, for the highest court in the land. But we also know that almost all of the appellate judges, meaning the circuit court judges who sit between the trial court judges and the Supreme Court, most of those, if not all of them that Trump has picked, are from the Federal Society, are members or active participants in Federal Society events. And that society, you know, really is funded by unknown sources. Its biggest known donor is Donors Trust and Donors Capital, which are two funds that hide their donors. Another big donor is a big right-wing foundation. And of course, Charles Koch is a major multimillion-dollar donor over the years to the Federal Society. But Leonard Leo himself is someone who went to Cornell Law School. He ended up going to work for the Federal Society basically very early in his career, having joined it initially. And he has gotten very rich, it appears, from his work on judicial nominations. And I say that because he's claimed that he has been a volunteer for the president, so he doesn't fill out any financial disclosure forms that an employee of the federal government who's tasked with helping to choose judges would fill out. And I myself was at the Justice Department working on judicial nominations, and I know that all the lawyers in the White House Counsel's Office and the Justice Department who work on nominations go through a background check and have financial checks. But Leonard Leo, as a, quote, volunteer, does not reveal the sources of his income or his growth in assets. And we know that in 2018, the year that he was working to get Brett Kavanaugh installed in the court, he took basically a $100,000 pay cut from the Federal Society, but he paid off the mortgage on his home, a 30-year mortgage he paid off about 22 years early. And on the eve of the vote on Kavanaugh, the day that the Senate voted on cloture to move forward with his nomination, Leonard Leo closed on a $3.3 million mansion in Maine. So he has enriched himself while he's been playing this role, and no one knows who's making him richer because those sources are hidden from the American people. They're not required to be disclosed under current law. Subsequently, this year, he left his paid position at the Federal Society to be the co-chair of it overall, and created with some of these colleagues who've been working on these dark money groups with him, a new group, a for-profit group, to advance this agenda.
Lisa, do you want to say anything more about the Federalist Society and their agenda and who funds it, or have we covered that sufficiently?
Well, I would say that it's quite clear that the Federalist Society is funded by major corporations. A lot of the lawyers who are part of it work at law firms in defense of huge corporations. A number of the attorneys that are part of it are part of the GOP's efforts on election law, including a number of these lawsuits to make it harder for Americans to vote and to try to limit the ability of Americans to vote during this pandemic in terms of extensions that some states have tried to provide so people can vote. A lot of lawyers who work for huge corporations, as well as one of the biggest corporations on the planet, which is Koch Industries, which is led by Charles Koch, and its agenda really has been to change American law and change it in ways that advance those corporate interests and, in my view, really limit the rights of ordinary Americans. And in terms of Leonard Leo's role, it has also included this attack on core rights of women in this country, reproductive rights, as well as equality rights. And so I think that Leonard Leo's role in the judicial appointment process is very troubling, especially because he appears to have gotten very rich while doing this.
Lisa, you mentioned Charles Koch. Please talk about the efforts of his group, Americans for Prosperity.
Sure. Well, Americans for Prosperity is the political arm of Charles Koch, and Charles Koch has operated under a number of groups that have changed their names over the years. But recently, there was a memo that went out to his billionaire funders, his allies, in these efforts in which he talked expressly about working with the Federal Society on judicial nominations and on other issues. And just to be clear, I'm not suggesting that Leonard Leo is engaged in illegal activity. I think there are substantial gaps in the law that have been exploited that have allowed this person to play such a decisive role without having any meaningful disclosure to the American people. But Charles Koch is one of the main proponents of that attack on our election laws, on anti-corruption laws. And in fact, earlier this year, I documented how his money helped subsidize the original decision in Buckley versus Leo in terms of the litigation in that case back in 1976, which is the root of the Citizens United decision and this effort to limit our ability to take action to limit the influence of dark money forces like Charles Koch, basically, on our elections. But the agenda of AFP is quite broad and I think has been very damaging for America. For example, it was Americans for Prosperity in its predecessor name, Citizens for a Sound Economy, that really first pushed forward in a big way the effort to repeal Glass-Steagall, which was the protection that was passed after the Great Depression, after the meltdown of Wall Street back in 1929, to prevent banks from engaging in this kind of, the kind of gambling that wrecked our economy in 2008. It was America's prosperity that really, in its predecessor form, Citizen for a Sound Economy, that helped work on efforts to attack Kyoto and the initial efforts 30 years ago to try to stem the tide of climate change that was underway. It played a key role in trying to push forward this narrative of denial and uncertainty around climate change. It has engaged in an array of activity to make it harder to regulate corporations like Koch Industries and pollution, but it also partnered with the tobacco industry on trying to limit the impact or the reach of regulations around tobacco, which causes cancer and kills people. Its record is one of trying to take away from the federal government's power of taxation and state governments as well to tax in order to have a government that functions well for the American people. And so in the states, it plays a very a heavy political role through its C4 operation in the states and elections. And in fact, even though Charles Koch has attempted to distance himself from Trump the man, Charles Koch and his operations have worked quite well and closely with Trump the administration to dismantle regulations that protect Americans' rights to clean air, cleaner air and cleaner water, as well as the Consumer Financial Protection Board, as well as this ongoing effort to attack and erode the Affordable Care Act. But not just that, back in 2016, Americans for Prosperity played a key role in swing states in moving voters out and toward Trump in terms of buoying Trump's efforts in 2016, even though Charles Koch himself did not endorse Trump.
We're speaking with Lisa Graves, the great investigator. Lisa, this information is really quite extraordinary. Both of us are from Wisconsin, and as a consequence, I've always taken an interest in the Bradley Foundation, which is centered in Wisconsin. Can you talk about the Bradley Foundation and the role that it plays?
The Bradley Foundation is a fascinating case study in one of the things that has happened with wealth and influence in America. This is a foundation that was created from the wealth of two brothers who had an industrial, you know, endeavor, you know, series of factories in essence in Milwaukee, and that got very, very rich. They were extremely hostile to labor rights and to, you know, progressive ideas in America. And they created a foundation back more than 50 years ago to put their wealth into this sort of tax-protected philanthropy, or put a portion of their wealth in it. It now has more than $750 million in assets, so it's nearly a $1 billion enterprise. And while they are long gone and their family members are no longer on the board of the Bradley Foundation is led by two other billionaires, by Art Pope, who has worked long with Charles Koch and David Koch previously at Americans for Prosperity in advancing that agenda, and Diane Hendricks, who's one of the biggest donors to the Republican Party alongside Art Pope here in Wisconsin. And they help steer the money of that foundation to advance this right-wing agenda in America to really remake the United States. That includes efforts to push these charter schools and efforts that take money out of public schools and put it into basically private hands, which is a longstanding part of the right-wing effort of Charles Koch and Milton Friedman to limit public schools, to take away the idea of public schools and put more of that money into private hands and private education, education that may not actually include information that people need to know to be really well-informed citizens, but rather push a particularly narrow ideological agenda. But the Bradley Foundation has also played a role behind the scenes, as Senator Whitehouse spoke about this past month, which is that they've been funding amicus briefs, which are briefs, so-called friend of the court briefs, that are written to the U.S. Supreme Court to try to influence them on rulings. And that includes on cases involving the Affordable Care Act and also on labor cases. So the predecessor to the Janus case you mentioned is a case that this foundation was funding through a group called the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which also is funded by Charles Koch, to attack both labor rights and Americans' rights to access affordable health care. And so it plays I think, a very significant role in funding the right-wing infrastructure. And as Bill Cohen just covered in Vanity Fair this week, it has had a significant relationship with a number of the writers of the Wall Street Journal's editorial board, including giving some of them what's called the Bradley Prize, which is a $250,000 gift for their supposed excellence in advancing that agenda.
Lisa, in January of this year, Leonard Leo started a new group called CRC Advisors. What do you know about it?
Well, we know that it is this group is tied to one of his best friends, in essence, this guy named Greg Mueller, who was running CRC, which was previously known as Creative Response Concepts. That's an advertising media firm that, you know, has been active in a lot of campaigns, including getting money from Charles Koch's groups like Americans for Prosperity to advance its agenda. This group is working with a number of other sort of shell groups or front groups that are tied to some of the same individuals that have been working with Leo on this court capture, and that includes Neil Corkery and Ann Corkery, who were previously the leaders of the Wellspring Committee. Wellspring Committee was a group that was basically a pass-through for the money of some of these big donors in order to influence policy and courts in this country. It would receive, for instance, a check from an unknown source for like $24 million and then give almost all that money to another group tied to Leonard Leo called the Judicial Crisis Network, which is the group that was has been most active in advertising for these Trump judicial appointees to the Supreme Court. But it's also tied to other for-profit and nonprofit groups that are also tied to Leonard Leo, that Leonard Leo has a ownership interest in. And so it's quite the nest of, or what I think of as almost like a shell game, of LLCs and nonprofits that are all working to influence who gets on our courts for lifetime positions, and who is really funding them is kept hidden from the American people.
Nancy McLean and Jane Mayer have written about the influence of dark money on the selection of state legislatures and governors and judges, and in drafting and promoting laws that favor the rich. They demonstrate that this has been part of a many decades project. Your thoughts about that, please.
Well, I think Nancy's precisely right on that point. And her book, Democracy in Chains, is really an important read. What she described is how this notion of what I call free market fundamentalism has really taken hold within the current Republican Party, which has been in many ways taken over by the sort of Koch libertarian theories. What that means is when you see these groups, they'll say things like, with respect to Amy Coney Barrett or the Federal Society, that they favor limited constitutional government. In terms of other groups like the American Legislative Exchange Council or Americans for Prosperity, these other two Koch-funded groups, they call it limited government. And that's really a clever way of saying limited democracy. Limited democracy is their objective, which is why Nancy's book, Democracy in Chains, is such an accurate description of what they have been doing in the United States and abroad. And that's this effort to basically enshrine this sort of free market notion that the free market knows best and that government should not be engaged in the public good, that we shouldn't have things like Social Security, we shouldn't have public schools, we shouldn't have the public really do anything besides protect property. That's a very radical reactionary view of government, and it really stems from one of the key influencers on Charles Koch's life, which was this guy named Bob Lefevre, who ran a thing called the Freedom School that was described as a, quote, anarcho-capitalist school. It was basically just a school in outside of Colorado Springs where millionaires and right-wingers would come to learn about this philosophy. Bob Lefevre refused to call himself an anarchist. He described himself as an autarchist as a way to around that term. But in essence, the idea was that government really has no place in society in what they view as in everything it does impinging the rights of corporations and individuals except for the protection of private property through police. That is just a view of America that is not consistent with our actual Constitution, with our founding principles and with modern modern interpretations of our rights through the Civil Rights Act and others that sought to give meaning and effect to principles in our Constitution like equal protection of the law. And so we certainly have a right to have laws that protect against discrimination under the 14th Amendment. We certainly have a right to have laws that Congress can pass and that agencies can promulgate through regulation to protect our rights to clean air and clean water, our rights as citizens to regulate that through our legislature.
Lisa Graves, we're unfortunately coming to an end of our allotted time. With that in mind, I wanted to ask you what you're working on now and how can our listeners keep in touch with you and keep in touch with your work?
Oh, well, thank you so much, Michael. I am a proud graduate of the University of Wisconsin at La Crosse. I believe it's vitally important that Americans have access to quality education that is affordable if it's not free. People can find me at truenorthresearch.org and Koch Docs, that's D-O-C-S, kochdocs.org. And I'm happy to come on anytime and talk with you and Heidi. It's a joy to be on your show.
Thank you so much, Lisa Graves.
Thank you. Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.